Welcome to the political cesspool, known across the South and worldwide as the South's foremost populist conservative radio program. And here to guide you through the murky waters of the political cesspool is your host for tonight, James Edwards.
Hello again, everybody. Welcome to the Political Cesspool radio program. I am your host, James Edwards, and I'm coming to you live from AM 1380 WLRN radio studios in Memphis, Tennessee. It's Saturday, September 12th, and we're also being syndicated around the country nationwide on the Liberty News radio network to their AM and FM affiliate stations coast to coast. And, of course, you can tune in always via satellite and the Internet. We're glad to have you with us for another riveting and enthralling installment of our award-winning political talk radio program. Joining me tonight in the Political Cesspool, co-hosting the first hour, Keith Alexander. Keith, my friend, how's it going?
Everything's great. Glad you could join us tonight, James. I was worried for a moment.
Yes, I mean, it's any time I can join you, Keith, and our listening audience, it's an honor and a pleasure. It's a privilege. It's all of those P words that are hard to pronounce, and tonight is no different. And we got a good show tonight, Keith. I'm really excited about the first hour that I'm going to be hosting with you. We've got quite a few subjects that I think are really going to pique the interest of our friends out there tuning in around the world. And, of course, this is a very significant weekend. It was 8 years ago yesterday that those evil Muslims that attacked the World Trade Center because they hate our freedoms and for no other reason than that. Or was that exactly what happened? Well, we're going to look at that issue, examine it once again with Dr. Stanley Monteith. Dr. Monteith is a fellow radio host. He is an author, and he is an expert on 9/11. So we are going to have the conversation about 9/11 that you probably didn't see on any other mainstream radio program or television broadcast this week. And we're going to try to get to the bottom of what really happened that day and let you be the judge. That's forthcoming later on in the program tonight, Keith. Right out of the gates, we saw a news article that appeared, an article that was written in Newsweek magazine. Now, Newsweek magazine has been on our radar here in the political cesspool this summer, Keith, because, of course, they wrote an article that mentioned us a couple of months back. And in addition to that, they came up with another article just this week in their most recent issue that claims that apparently all babies, or at least all white babies, are born racist. Was that not the gist of the story, Keith? What did you find out?
Well, Newsweek, of course, is an extremely liberal publication, and as we are wont to say at the Political Cesspool, liberalism is like a virus. It causes every institution and organization that embraces it to sicken and die, and that's apparently what's happening to Newsweek. There's another article this week about how Newsweek had unprecedented losses over the last quarter, the most in the Washington Post publishing group. And there are people talking about speculating that Newsweek may be not long for this world, may be going out of business. And you can see why when they write articles like this, which I think the name of the article is called See Baby Discriminate. And it's basically a story about the author, who is a liberal from San Francisco, that was dismayed that his child started indicating a kind of sense of what Kevin McDonald and Christopher Donovan at the Occidental Quarterly have called implicit whiteness. In other words, a sense of white racial solidarity, even though they had taken great pains to raise him a good liberal and to send him to this diverse multicultural preschool.
Okay, so basically something that is wholesome by nature's standards is beginning to occur in human beings at a young age, and it's all well and good if it's anyone except for Europeans or European Americans, and so Newsweek has to do this big article about it. And you mentioned, Keith, the not so surprising stat that Newsweek is very much in the red, and it comes as no surprise that that would be the case, because who are they pandering to? I mean, who reads Newsweek? Who reads?
Seriously, right?
I mean, why would they try to alienate their readership? The only people who buy these things are upper middle class, literate, educated white men and women, and why would we want to read things so alien and so counterintuitive to our own natural instinct?
Well, you know, I think everybody's appetite for masochism reaches a point, and I don't think that there are that many white people in America that really can want to support an organization that is constantly belittling them and demonizing them, and that's what...
Well, you just hit two key words there, Keith. Belittling, demonizing. We are told day in and day out by any number of mainstream publications and outlets and venues and forums how evil we are inherently as a people and how we have been basically the destructive force throughout the history of civilization when, quite frankly, and as a matter of fact, the exact opposite is true. Just about all of the goodness and advancements in technology and science, so on and so forth, they have come from the brains and from the hearts and souls of our people. And we are glad that we could create these things that all of humanity can enjoy. But as Pat Buchanan has said, we've heard the grievances. Where is the gratitude and where is the respect that I think our people, as a family, have earned?
Well, and it's implicit, according to this article. It says the white children, 5 to 7, attending racially diverse schools universally had a better opinion of their own race than of other races. See, the most dangerous thing for white people is to be away from black people so that they can, when they're thrust together with them, they don't have any opportunity to develop these, you know, pipe dreams about the equality of man, even more, the superiority of non-whites to whites, which, quite frankly, liberalism depends on for its survival.
Well, they absolutely do, Keith, and we'll see how it is going to play out for Newsweek, as well as, of course, this is a trend that has been pretty much widespread throughout all of the nation's newspapers, all of the daily publications, the newspapers in Memphis and obviously in Denver and some of these other bigger cities in the country. They're either bankrupt or absolutely out of business. And you can understand it. I mean, who wants to read that kind of nonsense? And particularly when it's patently untrue in so much as that this is a negative thing and it's something that should be frowned upon. Who wants to read something that they know is dangerous to them?
Well, see, what it shows, James, is that apparently
subscribe to these philosophies.
The people that are running our print media in America apparently have a mission they consider to be more important than making money, because all, as you pointed out, the major daily newspapers are in trouble. The major weekly magazines like Newsweek and Time are in trouble financially, and they're in trouble because they keep trying to force-feed this liberal worldview on their readers, and people, one, know it's false, two, know it's poisonous, and three, are not about to participate in their own dispossession, and as a result, subscribership keeps trending downward, and, it's soon the only people who are going to be reading something like Newsweek are vegetarians and college professors, and I don't think there are enough of them in America.
Yeah, I don't know how big of a market that is. It's a hell of a business model, isn't it, Keith? Once again, we want to demonize, vilify, just in a general way make our readers feel bad about who they are and how they were born. And it's no surprise, as we've said, that these people and these organizations are going out of business, and thank God for that. And if you want to read this article, ladies and gentlemen, that we've been referring to, and you read it in all of its, I would say glory normally, but whatever the opposite of glory would be, you can read it in all of that. It's on our website, thepoliticalcesspool.org. Go to the blog, and you can read this article that comes from Newsweek that basically says all European-American babies are born racist. But compare and contrast the state of affairs at Newsweek to this radio program, Keith. This radio program, our show here, started out 5 years ago with no name recognition, obviously. We were a show built from scratch. We had no supporters, no sponsors. We just basically started it as a way to get this message across, and we were going to see how it went. And who would have thought that it would have gone this good? But here's Newsweek and all of these major giants out there going bankrupt. They can't find the money. And here we are reaching an audience, my goodness, tens of thousands of people every week tune into this show or read us on the blog or listen to us in the archives. And we were able to do that on basically a non-existent budget, and yet we're operating in the black. We have a very meager budget, but with that meager budget, we were able to reach a great, great number of people. I mean, an insane amount of people compared to where we were 5 years ago. And here's people like Newsweek that can't afford to keep the doors open. What's the difference between our program and theirs? We are trying to encourage our audience. We are trying to give our audience the kind of message that they want to hear. And they're gravitating to the message. We don't tailor our message to the audience. I guess I should rephrase. We have a message that we believe in and that our convictions compel us to espouse, and the audience has come to that message, whereas all of these other publications are basically spouting an alien message, and it's being rejected.
Well, unlike Newsweek and the New York Times and the Washington Post, we don't despise our audience.
Don't go away. The political.
We got to take a break. We'll be back right after this.
After these messages.
Don't let me be misunderstood. Don't let me be misunderstood.
Please don't understand me, baby.
Don't let me be misunderstood.
Don't misunderstand.
Jump in the political cesspool with James and the gang. Call us tonight at 1-866-986-6397. And here's the host of the political cesspool, James Edwards.
And we're going to open up those phone lines to you, ladies and gentlemen, during our second and third hours tonight. So if you can be patient, I know some callers have already tried to get on the line with us live this evening. We're going to open up those phone lines during the second and third hour tonight when we talk about an increasing variety of topics, not the least of which being a revisitation of what really happened or what might have really happened on the attacks of September 11th, 2001. This is the weekend of that horrific anniversary, and we're going to be examining it in greater detail with Dr. Stanley Monteith. A little later on in the program, we'll take your calls as well. Keith, I know we've got much more to cover here during the first hour that we have with you on the program tonight, this Saturday evening, September 12th. And as we segue away from the issue we were addressing during the first segment, that being the Newsweek article and how they conduct their business compared and contrasted with how we like to present our audience with a healthy and encouraging message, it warrants a reading of this letter we got in the mail. We are always ecstatic and excited to hear correspondence, good, bad, and indifferent, as long as it's objective, as long as it's not the asinine death threats that we receive on a weekly basis or just garbage, profanity-laced emails. We love hearing from our listening audience. If they have something objective that they want to convey to us. And we especially like it when it's an encouraging letter and it comes from someone who has been influenced by our work here. But this was just so thoughtful and so well written, Keith. I wanted to share it with you because it harkens back to something, Keith, that you and I talk about quite often in between shows. Of course, the Political Cesspool crew is a very close-knit bunch, and we get together for lunch and business meetings throughout the week to plan the next program that we're going to be doing on Saturday night and so on and so forth. And we talk about, we reflect, reminisce, and talk about where the show has come and where we'd like to see it go and what we're all about. And Keith, this gentleman writes from Oklahoma. He's a listener that we have in Oklahoma, and he writes something that we were reflecting upon just last week, and this is what he says. Hello, everyone, at the Political Cesspool. Just yesterday, I was listening to your fantastic interview with the Occidental Quarterly's editor, Dr. Greg Johnson. As a longtime subscriber to the Occidental Quarterly, I always listen to and read everything they put out. What a fantastic show you have, especially when you combine ideas with the likes of Dr. McDonald, Dr. Sunik, Dr. Johnson, Jared Taylor, Nick Griffin, and the list goes on and on. About halfway through your interview with Greg, I was a little astonished when he mentioned that a question on one of your past shows directed him and had also given him the idea for a recent essay contest concerning libertarianism and racial nationalism. I was excited and proud to know that he was indeed referring to me and the question that I had emailed you. It's nice to know that a person can have an impact if they just show some participation and thoughtfulness. I have to admit that listening to your show while I drive, take hikes, or work out has become so routine that I almost forgot to do my part as a dedicated listener. A listener who constantly receives such great value from the ideas generated from your conversation, your show airs. Well, here is another donation. It's my way of saying thank you. I appreciate all that you do, and I want to remain one of the people that you can always count on. The daunting task before us is a great deal easier when you know you're not alone. Well done, and that comes from Stacy in Oklahoma, Keith, and we can't say enough. And just to show our appreciation for that kind letter, I wanted to read it on the air and share it with you and everyone else.
I think he's probably typical of a lot of our listeners. I think that we provide a very needed service, which is highly educated commentary on topics of race realism and on white solidarity that just aren't going to be found anywhere else on the airwaves.
Well, you're exactly right, Keith, and I didn't want to take up so much time in this segment, but when you get a letter like that, I feel obligated to read it because that's really what we're all about, and Stacy gets it. He gets the idea of what this show is here to do, the objective that we're here to accomplish, and he understands that we're quite proud of the list of just incredible guests that we've had on the air, and we're going to continue to bring that kind of great programming to you. But anyway, Keith, not to dwell on that too long, but thank you, Stacy in Oklahoma, for writing that. We stand with you, sir, 100%, and we're blessed to have your support. Keith, I know you wanted to tackle another topic as we head into the second segment of tonight's live broadcast.
Well, let me use this as a kind of segue from the last article. The last article that we were talking about, the Newsweek article, See Baby Discriminate, boiled down to its essence, basically complains that there is this phenomenon that we've discussed before that's discussed in the Occidental Quarterly by Kevin McDonald, Christopher Donovan, and others called implicit whiteness, which means that at a kind of subliminal level, most white people, even self-professed white liberals, behave with a sense of white racial solidarity. They live in white neighborhoods. They attend white churches. They go to white civic clubs and organizations. They enjoy the company of other white people. And this is, of course, what's normal and natural for all groups. Black people do the same thing. Asians do the same. And, indeed, what this next thing that we're going to show is that people do it when they send their children to school. But everybody doesn't admit to it. For example, Eddie the Bombardier Miller, our dear friend and one of our staff members, pointed out the other day, I wonder how Jewish schools, private schools, stack up in regard to diversity, since the Jewish segment of the population seems to always be recommending multiculturalism and diversity to other groups of whites. And I said, well, that's an interesting topic. I'm going to do some research. I've done some research, at least in the Memphis area, where we have three Jewish schools. And guess what I found, James?
What'd you find, Keith? Tell me. I'm going to be shocked, I'm sure.
That when you break down the demographics by ethnicity, it says white, not Hispanic, 100% for each one of them. Now, of course.
Okay, so let me get this straight now. Like, once again, I'm just baffled by that. It defies logic, I guess. I just can't believe it. I don't know if anybody can pick up the sarcasm there, but nevertheless. You're saying that the three Jewish schools in Memphis have 100% non-diversity? It's like an apartheid school system, basically?
Right, yes. And, of course, only one of them even bothers to put that EEOC, Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, language that is required of every other private school in town that says they're equal opportunity and that they do not discriminate on the basis of race, gender, or religious faith and whatnot. Well, it's obvious that they do, because they don't have one person that's black or Hispanic. I've looked at the pictures, and quite frankly, I would be very surprised if they had any non-Jews attending those schools. But so, on the other hand, when it comes to other private schools, ones run by Christian denominations, ones that are independent, they insist, and they're constantly beating the drum, that minorities be given scholarships one way or another. They've got to be part of the student body. But when it comes to their own schools, somehow the silence is deafening on this topic.
I wonder why the hypocrisy and the double standards. You would stand to reason that the greatest practitioners, obviously they're anything but practitioners of it, but the greatest advocates of diversity would be the ones to be practicing it the most. And yet in the Memphis area, at least upon our preliminary research, we find that they are almost 100% if not absolutely 100% Jewish. So the Jewish parents who love diversity and multiculturalism so much don't seem to love it enough to subject their own children to it, do they?
Well, it's what they call diversity for thee, but not for me. And it's just like the Jewish nation, Israel. You know, they are constantly lobbying America to become more diverse, to open our borders, to let third worlders in, to integrate our society in every way. But in Israel, you can't be Jewish and be a citizen.
Well,
and furthermore, non-Jews can't even own real estate.
And let me just go on record as saying I love the Israeli domestic policy. I don't mind shouting that from the rooftops. And what is this? Is this some anti-Semitic screed? Well, far from it. We got to take a break, and we'll tell you why it's not when we return.
If you knew Peggy Sue, then don't go away. The Political Cesspool guys will be back right after these messages. Peggy Sue. Get on the show and express your opinion in the political cesspool. Call us toll-free at 1-866-986-6397. We've got to get out of
this place. Welcome back to the award-winning Political Cesspool radio program. It's Saturday evening, September 12th. I'm your host, James Edwards, joined in studio right now, co-hosting with me for the first hour, Keith Alexander. And don't forget to go to our website, ladies and gentlemen, thepoliticalcesspool.org. We have a snazzy new logo that we've just unveiled this week, and it's there for your viewing pleasure, along with all of the other great features that you can find at our official Internet headquarters. You can get the blog. Read the blog. Man, everybody loves the blog. You got to go check out the blog. Sign up for our email list. You can go to our video page, photo page, contact us. There's so much to see and do. It's sort of like a vacation in of itself. It's like a theme park for websites, thepoliticalcesspool.org. And continuing on, Keith, what I was saying right before the last break, obviously a lot of people who, I guess, just rely on hysteria to navigate their political beliefs would say, oh my God, you're saying that Jewish people don't practice diversity. That's anti-Semitic to objectively point out the facts or objectively critique or criticize something that Jewish folks do is in and of itself Nazi-like. Well, of course, we know that's not what we're about, and that's not what motivates us. What motivates us is to shatter hypocrisies and double standards. That's one of the main reasons we do this radio program. And in mentioning the fact that the Jewish schools in Memphis, much like the Jewish schools all over the United States and elsewhere, are everything but diverse, is something that I think people should be aware about. And what are we saying also? Are we saying that the Jews by themselves forced this multiculturalism upon us? No, not at all. They did have their fingerprints on them, on the movement, and on a lot of things that I think have been anti-American and anti-Christian. But without the traitors and the Congress and the Senate, it would have never been possible that all of these egalitarian and left-wing movements would have gained traction from the 1950s onward. But the fact of the matter is, at the bottom line of it, at the end of the day, and there's exceptions to every rule, and we've had people like Dr. Paul Gottfried on that we can find a lot of common ground. But by and large, most Jewish people are liberal. They admit it. There have been many number of polls taken on it. It's just a matter of fact. It's an incontrovertible fact. So much so is it a fact, Keith, that Jewish neoconservatives Norman Podhoretz wrote a new book called Why Are Jews Liberal? This is a Jew writing this book, Why Are Jews Liberal? Now, there's 1,000 reasons for that, which Podhoretz addresses in the closing pages of this book, bringing history and autobiography together to suggest that, and I quote, liberalism has become for many Jews not simply a substitute for religion, but a religion itself. This is Podhoretz writing here, Keith, with roots in the history he describes, and a set of doctrines and dogmas adhered to with the force of faith. For many modern Jews, conversion from liberalism to conservatism is roughly equivalent to what conversion to Christianity was to their ancestors in Eastern Europe. And if you want to read more about Norman Podhoretz's new book, Why Are Jews Liberal, we have that linked on our website, thepoliticalcesspool.org. So it's not just us talking here, Keith, and pointing this out, and you can do with this information what you will. If you think it's no big deal, fine, but we want to bring it to your attention. But again, people like Podhoretz readily recognize that this is fact.
Well, you know, James, I wouldn't be surprised if he wasn't motivated to write that article by the buzz that we started at the Political Cesspool, because we were, I think, the first people that I can recall that pointed out the link between Jewish people and liberalism on the airways. You know, you just don't hear that, but we've talked about it so often and so frequently that I think that the word is getting out there in the mainstream, and consequently Jewish advocates like Norman Podhoretz felt a need to address it. Now, we were talking about the schools earlier. Just think of what would happen if a Baptist school, private school in Memphis, or an Episcopalian school or an independent school had no black or Hispanic students whatsoever. You would read banner headlines on the local newspaper. There would be picketers outside the school. There would be some federal lawsuit filed. And who would be at the forefront of it? Probably members of the Jewish community. And why is there this double standard? It's quite obvious that people, you know, it's just like Podhoretz says, if you meet a Jewish person, just know this background. The chances are 4 out of 5 that you're going to be encountering a liberal. And not just a regular liberal, probably a hard leftist.
And I wonder why that is. There has to be some sort of reason for that, that they all tend to, you know, skew that way. But
well, you could do a lot worse than to read Kevin MacDonald's book, The Culture Critique and A People That Shall Dwell Alone. He goes into the reasoning for this, but regardless of what the reasons are, it's still a fact.
Well,
and
these are facts.
People can't ignore the facts. If you ignore the facts, you do so at your own peril, and we'll continue to speak about it because, as the Bible says, the truth will set you free.
Well,
give light to people will find their own way.
We continue to try to present these facts in the most non-sensational way as possible. We don't do this to try to be fantastic. We try to do this to just tell the truth in love, because we are motivated for a love of our people and a love of our history and culture, and that's something that we're fighting quite hard on this program to preserve and protect. But I also want to be clear about another thing. I in no way am condemning the Jewish people for the way that they practice these policies domestically. In fact, you know, I applaud them for doing what's in the best interest of their children, keeping them in circles.
But I wish they were not so intent upon forcing this on the rest of us. Because
yeah, absolutely. Now, that is something that I absolutely
believe, despise.
That's something that I take great issue at, that the biggest, as we said in the previous segment, the biggest advocates of this diversity and multiculturalism are the people who practice it the least. So I applaud them for doing what they know in their heart is healthy and natural, but I have a great deal of concern, to say the least, that these same people who know what is right, they must know it's right because that's what they want for their own families, why would they be so hell-bent on forcing it on our throat,
probably
which they don't want for themselves? That's a question that needs to be answered.
Probably the best example ever of what they call implicit whiteness. But just be aware that, you know, here at the Cesspool, we believe that liberalism is the modern face of evil. Everything that has come about within the past 55 years has been destructive of good morals, of a healthy nation, a healthy economy, has come from the political left. None of this, you know, the sexual revolution, the drug culture, school integration, none of these things was proposed by the John Birch Society. And if liberalism is bad, then you've got to inquire, if you've got an inquiring mind, who are the liberals?
Well, and we know we know one ethnic group that is, as you said, Keith, about 75%, 80% liberal by their own testimonies, and that this is something, listen.
Yeah, yeah. Norman Podhoretz doesn't try to deny it, and furthermore, he very candidly says it's going to remain that way for the foreseeable future, that Jews are going to be predominantly liberal. So be forewarned.
Well, and again, if we try to present these, I don't want to say taboo. There's nothing taboo about telling the truth, but we try to present these, I guess, maybe sensitive, I don't know what you want to call it, whatever. We try to present these issues as professionally and as intellectually as possible. We talk about issues such as this, obviously amongst ourselves as we're doing right now, but we try to have on the experts, the people with credentials, people like Dr. Kevin McDonald, who provide
well, the next time you encounter a Jewish person arguing for diversity and political correctness and multiculturalism, you ought to bring up these topics and find out what they have to say about it.
Well, you know, we've got to engage in the court of public opinion. If freedom of speech still exists, then we ought to be able to talk about any topic as adults, and certainly that's something that we try to do on this program, regardless of what the issue may be. And it just so happens that the issue right now is this double standard that we see here pertaining to this particular, I guess you would call them an ethnostate. But anyway, Keith, moving on from that, we're trying to cover as much ground as possible in the 3 hours we have available to us each week here as we are reaching an ever-expanding audience, and we know that our audience has vast and varied interests, and each person has his or her own signature interests, so we try to give them, I hate to use the word diversity, but we try to provide a diverse lineup of programming each night on the program. But what's next on our agenda tonight, Keith?
Well, when we talked about the question of diversity in the day-to-day life of Jewish people, for example, the student body makeup at Jewish schools, we're talking about a truth that is not widely known. It would be like Al Gore's book, An Inconvenient Truth. There are also truisms about conservatism that are false, that are not representative of true conservatism. For example, the idea that free trade is a conservative position, it's anything but.
Keith, sit tight, my friend. Got to take that break. We'll be back right after this.
Don't go away. The Political Cesspool guys will be back right after these messages.
We got to get out of this place. If it's the last thing we ever do, we got to get out of this place.
Welcome back. To get on the political cesspool, call us on James's Dime, toll free at 1-866-986-6397. And here's the host of the political cesspool, James Edwards.
Yes, sir, Mr. Art Frith. I am the host of the Political Cesspool, James Edwards, and we're going to be opening up those phone lines during our second and third hours this evening, that phone line being 1-866-986-NEWS. It's toll-free. You can get on the Political Cesspool live and be with us this evening as we continue on battling the Vandals and Visigoths of multiculturalism. And Keith Alexander, my co-host for this first hour tonight, is doing exactly that. We ran smack dab into that commercial break. I, as a host of this program, sometimes get so wrapped up in what's being said, I forget that we have to take those breaks from time to time, and they kind of sneak up on me. So, Keith, that being said, pick up right where you left off.
Well, as we are saying, there's occasionally unseen liberal hands at work that do not ascribe to liberalism in their own lives that we need to be aware of. There's also a species of phony conservatism out there that mainstream conservative groups like Fox News Network, Sean Hannity, Bill O'Reilly, people like that, try to foist on the public constantly that needs an airing just as much as the other. And what I had in mind here particularly is that in this healthcare debate about Obamacare, about nationalized healthcare, whenever they get a Republican to speak on the other side of the issue and say, well, what type of reform would you propose, they always say malpractice tort reform. In other words, tort reform is this great conservative issue that all conservatives should take to the ramparts for, and if we could just pass enough tort reform, everything would be right with the world. And of course, tort reform is another one of those phony conservative issues. In Mississippi, for example, they recently passed medical malpractice tort reform, putting caps on judgments in medical malpractice cases. So in Mississippi now, they can come and say, well, we killed your child. Sorry, here's your $250,000. Now go away, little boy, and don't bother me. And what the reality is that tort reform is a racial issue. It's not a conservative liberal issue. In the state of Mississippi, there are only, I got the Senate sponsor in the Mississippi Senate to agree to this, to admit to it. There are only four counties, four venues in the whole state where jackpot justice, where you have these large verdicts where that's a problem. And all four of those counties have the same thing in common. They all have supermajority populations of blacks, which means they have a supermajority jury pool of blacks. And what experience has proven is that the jury system, which is a product of our Anglo-Saxon heritage, doesn't work as well as it should when it is administered by non-Anglo-Saxon people, by non-whites. What happens, for example, is when you get others in, particularly blacks and Hispanics, you find that they look upon the jury system as an engine to redistribute the wealth of society. In venues where there is a majority white population, this jackpot justice isn't a problem at all. But, of course, this is like the emperor's new clothes. Nobody is going to mention that, particularly on a national news program. They'd rather take rights away from everybody rather than take steps to correct a very specific problem.
Keith, I'm listening to you, man, and I got to tell you, we're so lucky to have you as a commentator and as a pundit on this program. The way you articulate these issues in a way that is so intellectual but is also delivered in such a manner that everyone can understand it really excites me from time to time. We've got a good thing going here, and you are right on target, as usual.
You know, there is no reason for people, you know, let's tell the emperor he has no clothes. You know, what's happening is that we're being told that this is a systemic problem. Well, the Founding Fathers made the right to trial by jury one of the things they protected in the Bill of Rights. But we've got big business interests, the same business interests that gave us slavery so they could have cheap labor. They're the same business interests that are now giving us illegal immigration, ruining our nation and our culture so that they can again have access to cheap labor. They're the same people that want to do away with your God-given right, a right given to you by God and the Founding Fathers, to have a jury trial, which is one of the great safeguards against tyranny that we have built into our governmental system. They want you to forget about it. They want you to get rid of it because they don't find it convenient. They don't
because
want
hypothetically,
to deal with
it's
it.
A lot easier for
this is one of the things
be
that's happened because of the multiculturalism they forced it on.
Right, and as I was saying, with regard to why they hate the jury system so much, is that it'd be a lot easier for a judge to be corrupted than for a random group of 12 people selected from the citizenry.
And it'd be nice if they would take an honest look at jury results by county and by population in county and draw what is the obvious conclusion.
Try to find demographics went to the cash register when it came time to render the verdict?
That's right. And, you know, instead, there's a conspiracy of silence about that issue. You'll never hear that discussed on Sean Hannity or Bill O'Reilly or on the Fox News Network.
Hannity's terrible. I'm telling you, Keith, a couple of times a week I will tune in because, as we always say, you got to keep your friends close and your enemies closer. People like Sean Hannity and Rush Limbaugh and Glenn Beck.
Well, Glenn Beck, not
I hope
so
I'm not being
Rush
overly
Limbaugh
dramatic
so much,
here, but
at least opinion,
I think
but.
You could I think you could work up a pretty convincing argument that these people are doing more damage to conservatism than the most outspoken liberal.
Well, see, what they don't do is like a doctor misdiagnosing a disease. The diagnosis is that liberalism is killing America. It's not lawyers that are killing America. It's not preachers. It's not educators, it's not editors, it's liberal lawyers, liberal judges, liberal educators, liberal news media people, liberal educators. This is what is, you know, do you see the common strand here? It's liberalism that is killing America and, you know, trying to demonize entire classes of people like trial lawyers or doctors or media people, you've got to understand that the problem is liberalism. You know, write it down, write it on the back of your hand. The problem is liberalism. And if you got a diagnosis, we understand that we're never going to make any headway. It's like diagnosing a patient wrong. You administer the wrong medicine, and the medicine that's been administered in America over the past 55 years for what's ailing us as a nation is more and more liberalism, and the patient is on the verge of death.
And then it goes without saying, though, Keith, also that liberalism in and of itself is just an ideology. If you really want to cure the problem and fix what's ailing us, you got to go after and engage in the court of public opinion, as we like to say, those who carry the ideology of liberalism from theory to practice, and you got to designate who those people are, and you got to go after them. You got to go after them politically, at the ballot box, any way that you can, and you've got to root them out of the system, because as you said, Keith, liberalism is absolutely destroying the American experiment in what was once God's country.
Well, they say that America is the last best hope for mankind, and I believe that it is. And we're going to have to find out who the enemy is. You can't fight an enemy effectively if you can't identify them. And liberals are the enemy. And I don't care whether the liberal is, you know, what his race, ethnicity, or anything else is. Liberalism is a problem, and I'm very clear on that. I've studied this situation all my life. I've lived through the whole sweep of it, and I know where the problem lies.
Well, you know, I got another one for you, Keith, since we're on this subject. You know, again, I'm talking about you got to find out who the practitioners and the proponents of liberalism are. We already talked about 4 out of 5 Jewish folks are liberal by their nature and by their own admittance.
But they're also a very small group of people.
Getting back to Hannity, listen.
The population.
Yeah, you know, and I got to tell you about Hannity. Hannity, if you can believe this is how sick network conservatives are. Hannity was actually lamenting the fact that the election of Barack Obama was setting back race relations in this country. Now, he wasn't lamenting that for reasons that we might share. He was lamenting that because he said, you know, it's really setting us back because he's so left-wing, he's this, that, and the other. And some of that is accurate, but he said, you know, if we could have just elected an African-American, he said, that was a Reagan conservative, then we really could have brought the races together because it's Barack Obama's ideas, not his race, that alienates us. And, you know, I wanted to grab Sean by the coat collar and say, you know, there is not a Reagan Republican that is an African-American, so to speak, in this. They don't exist, not even the Republicans.
They're always trying to find them. I like your comment that you made to me one time that the perfect Republican candidate is a black lesbian that wants to cut taxes.
Yeah, they would love to have somebody like that. That would be their new standard bearer. But, I mean, they just don't get it. Well, maybe Hannity does get it, but he's never going to say it because that's not his job. His job is to be a GOP propagandist and a misinformation agent and make conservatives.
We're supposed to be colorblind, according to the mantra of the Civil Rights Movement.
You can't be a colorblind conservative. The two don't go hand in hand.
Well, the thing is, if they're colorblind, why are they so intent upon finding these scarce, possibly non-existent black conservatives or Hispanic conservatives,
Keith,
all the time?
We got to go to break. We'll be back with more. Man, I don't want to go to break. We got to. We'll be back in the second hour. Sit tight, everybody.
And two to go. Stay tuned. Hour number two of The Political Cesspool comes your way right after these messages.
And Harv leaped to his feet and said, something's got a hold on me. Yow! The day the squirrel went berserk in the First Self-Righteous Church in that sleeping little town of Pascagoula. It was a fight for survival that broke out in revival. Jumping pews and shouting, hallelujah.
Hallelujah.
Well, Harv hit the aisles dancing and screaming. Some thought he had religion, others thought he had a demon. And Harv thought he had a weed eater loose in his fruit of looms. He fell to his knees to plead and beg, and the squirrel ran out of his britches leg unobserved to the other side of the room. All the way down to the amen.